This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hey, y'all. I am Sam Sanders. You are listening to It's Been a Minute. On this show, I interview a fair amount of authors publishing memoirs. This interview is one of those, but it's different, perhaps, than every other one you've heard in this podcast. This is the first author, the first memoir interview, where I actually felt like I knew the guest, was friends with the guest, before our conversation. This guest is Saeed Jones. And I felt like I knew him because his Twitter feed is this open book and this amazing digital personal diary that I have been following for months. On his feed, Saeed tells you everything, and it's all equal parts poignant and hilarious. Makes you feel like you're living your life with him. Saeed Jones is an award-winning poet. His book of poems from a few years ago, Prelude to Bruise, it won a Stonewall Book Award in 2015. It was also a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. And now, Saeed Jones is out with his first memoir. It is called How We Fight for Our Lives. This book is all about Saeed's unique life story. He grew up Black and gay and Buddhist in suburban Texas. And he found a way over time to love himself and be himself without shame. This chat is a good one, but it's heavy. Saeed and I talk frankly and graphically about sex and sexuality and abuse. May not be the best conversation for kids to hear. Also, listeners, there's some sensitive and derogatory language involving a slur in this chat that we left unbleeped. Okay, Saeed was in Ohio. I was in L.A. at NPR West. Saeed Jones, enjoy. Hello, Saeed. Hi.
Well, I've already told your team this, but know that I'm incredibly hungover, and Columbus is wild, apparently. I need to move back to New York so I can have a calmer life.
You know, speaking of Columbus, this has been one of the big topics of your Twitter feed in the last few months. You were a longtime New Yorker, mm-hmm. and a few months ago you said, screw this, I'm going to Ohio, yeah. and you moved to Columbus, Ohio, what, how many months ago?
I moved just less than a month ago. I moved in, I think, September 1st.
Oh, my goodness. What made you mm-hmm. do that?
You know, I mean, as you said, I've been living in New York basically on and off for about a decade now. And much of that time has been, you know, working in media and news. And I just feel that the tenor of American life right now is so high-pitched and just really intense, especially, you know, and that's true for everyone.
Yeah.
But even more so, of course, if your job is to write or think about culture and, like, to really pay attention to it. And
yeah.
I needed a way to find a space where I could be a little more sustainable. Like, you know, I'm a very, like you said, open person. I talk constantly about what I'm going through, either on Twitter and in my writing. I have no problem sharing that part of my experience with people. But I think privately, on the personal level, you know, I realized that I needed to do a better job of taking care of myself, you know. And living in New York just felt like it's expensive and just so intense and loud, you know. And literally since I've moved here, I've been in Columbus for just under a month now, and I'm writing more and reading more than I have in years. You know, like, there's been an immediate change in my quality of life.
One of my favorite stories you've shared on Twitter about your move was ending up very soon after you got to Columbus, Ohio, ending up at an Ohio State tailgate party.
Yes, I'm wearing an OSU shirt. Right.
Look,
now.
you have gone full. You have gone full native out there. I love it. So, in a nutshell, sum up that day for our listeners.
Well, first of all, tailgate. I mean, you know, I grew up in Texas. I grew up in the suburbs of North Dallas. So, you know, I grew up with a relationship to football because football is just, it is the organizing principle in Texas.
Oh yeah, that and church. That's
so,
it. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Football and church. So, you know, I think some people might be thrown that I know as much as I'm like, oh, I did. I just like, you know, but I came out of the closet and was like, oh, good. I don't have to pretend to care about football anymore is always how I felt. What's funny then to now go tailgating here in Ohio is I feel like it's I've worked through my anxiety of about the experience. Like, it's not fraught as a space, and it's just really fun. And I hate that here it's very early in the morning. I mean, it's like 8 o'clock in the morning.
Well, in your tweets drinking about that tailgate, you tweeted it.
Oh, my
gosh. At one
gosh.
Point, it is 8:54 a.m., and I'm drinking a vodka Red Bull.
Right? And that was already, I think that was an hour into the experience. I mean, it's just so surreal. And it's just a sea of people wearing red shirts. My friend gave me an OSU shirt because he was like, oh, you absolutely cannot just be walking in there without Scarlet and Gray.
You
like, don't play girl.
I wanted to start with the tailgate party story because for me, in so many ways, it sums up Saeed, this ability to take a small thing and draw some big ideas out of it. And it also sums up the way I feel the book deals with how you move through the world. Like, what does it mean to be Saeed and live and thrive in spaces like an Ohio State tailgate party where there are very few people who look like you, very few folks who share the same background as you? What does it mean to move through spaces not made for you and not intended for you? And that is one of the big themes I found in your book.
Thank you. That's beautiful. Yeah, that's certainly the goal of the memoir. You know, I think, you know, oppression is wears us out in all kinds of ways. Mm. But something lately that I've been thinking about is just like how exhausting it is to struggle not to express yourself. Like, I don't believe anyone is voiceless. So when people are like, I want to be a voice for the voiceless, I'm like, no one's voiceless.
Yeah, they got a voice.
But
yeah.
I think they got a voice, but the struggle to get people to listen to you, you know, like you're talking and you're talking, but it can often feel like, you know, you're just talking in the void. And I know queer people, trans people, immigrants, you know, are like always trying to communicate to this country, like, this is what's going on. You know, this is what it is to be me and to feel unwelcome in this place that's supposed to be welcoming. And so I think the tension in knowing how you feel about your existence and not feeling heard is intense and it's exhausting. So with the memoir, you know, one of my goals was to allow readers to be kind of in my body, to kind of be with me, you know, in my internal kind of conversation, and to see what the cost of that dynamic is over time, you know. Something I tell people often, I'm like, listen, this isn't a book where, you know, I know I'm growing up as a gay kid in the suburbs of North Texas. This isn't a book about me being like shoved in the locker room, you know, and being bullied and stuff. I'm bullying myself. Because I think one of the things that can begin to take hold of us when we are made to feel unwelcome is that we begin to kind of self-narrate that harassment, you know.
And we do it to ourselves.
We do it to ourselves. We say the mean thing first before anyone else can say it. Yeah. And I think I did that a lot when I was young, and thought, in part because I think I thought I could prepare myself, inoculate myself.
Yeah.
But instead of inoculating, I think I was just being cruel to myself. That's all that was happening.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. When you think about that and getting over that, the Saeed that went to that Ohio State tailgate a few weeks ago, how did he handle that kind of environment better or more deliberately than the Saeed who was still being cruel to himself at the open of this book might have?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I enjoyed myself. I think
that is a good thing.
You know, I mean, that's a good thing. I had fun. I mean, you know, and I've got to say that, like, this is ongoing, and you know, there are ups and downs. You know, I'm not going to pretend like I wrote the book and everything's just better now and perfect. You know, but I mean, as recently as even, you know, a year ago, there are still moments when, like I mentioned, like going to a sports bar. If I go into a space, you know, and if the atmosphere is aggressive and kind of scary, like, I've had panic attacks.
Wow.
I've had to leave bars or nightclubs because I can't, you know. I remember doing a reporting trip in New Orleans in 2013, I think. And I ended up going to a bar that was, you know, I think there was a lot of queer people there, but it was very much, like, as true of all of New Orleans, very much a mixed, fluid kind of cultural Creole space, you know. And I remember having to leave that night because every time it was very crowded, and every time someone bumped into me or I bumped into them, I would have just a moment of panic because I was like, am I going to get in a fight? Whatever, you know. And so my friend, you know, and I explained, I was like, I have to leave. I'm so sorry.
Really?
I was like, okay. And we're like walking back to our hotel, and the, you know, now it's like 2 o'clock in the morning in New Orleans, walking back to the quarter. And, you know, and I'm explaining to him, I was like, well, you know, I hooked up with this straight guy once and he tried to kill me. And now when I'm like, it's a whole thing that like, we're having this like sober, you know, we're crying as we're walking.
Yeah.
And I will never forget a car pulling up beside us and it had tinted windows and one of the windows rolled down and someone yelled, "You faggot."
Oi. Oi.
At us. And my friend just turned and said, "You're not helping." It was the most surreal, like, oh my God, oh, is my this a goodness. Metaphor? What's happening?
Oh my goodness.
But all that's to say, like, you know, a huge source of joy for me now is that it's easier for me to be myself wherever I am.
Yeah.
And I think the thing about identity is that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Oh.
If we are in a space and we feel unsafe and we're worried about being unsafe, that space becomes unsafe.
There you go.
Right? Like it's a weird dynamic. But on the other hand, you know, if I'm like, I'm here, I deserve to be here.
Yes.
This room is better because I'm in the
yes.
room. It's a better room, you know?
you
so that's definitely something that I figured out. Make the room better.
Make
yeah.
the room better. I love it. So this book, you know, usually I'll have writers come on and give me like a 30-second elevator pitch for the book before we really dig into it.
Okay.
What I would rather you do, because we know now this mm-hmm. is a memoir about you growing up Black, queer, and amazing in Texas, etc. I think the best elevator pitch for this book is the poem that occurs at the beginning of it. I'm talking about Elegy with Grown Folks Music. Could you read that?
Absolutely.
I love it. Okay.
Elegy with Grown Folks Music. "I Want to Be Your Lover" comes on the kitchen radio, and briefly, your mother isn't your mother. Just like, if the falsetto is just right, a Black man in black lace panties isn't a faggot, but a prince, a prodigy. And the woman with your hometown between her hips shimmies past the eviction notice burning on the counter, and her body moves like she never even birthed you. The voice on the radio pleads, "I want to be the only one that makes you come running." Some songs take women places men cannot follow. Spinning, she looks at but doesn't see you. Spinning, she sings lyrics too fast for you to pursue. Spinning, she doesn't have time for questions like, "What is this nasty song? And where did she learn to dance like that? And why? And who is this high-pitched of a man who can sing like a woman and turn your mother not into your mother, but a woman? Not even a woman, but a box braided black girl, a fast girl, a chick, a vanity six, and how far away she is from you, right here in the same living room, dancing with the song's hook in her throat. And you hate the voice coming through the radio because another sissy has snatched your dreams and run off with them, and because you are young and don't know the difference between abandoned and alone, just like your mother's heart won't know the difference between beat and attack. She will be dead in a decade, and maybe you already know what you are losing without knowing how. But you're just a boy for now, and your mother is just a woman, just a girl, body swaying, fingers snapping, and snakes in her blood."
Mm. Wow. I love it. It gives me chills. When you say, "Turn your mother not into your mother, but a woman. Not even a woman, but a box-braided black girl." I love that setup because in reality, what this book felt like for me was not just a memoir of Saeed, but a memoir of your mother, too.
Right.
This is...
Yeah. It is.
Yeah. And that is something. You know, you have written this book that is a love letter to her, an explanation of her and y'all's relationship, but she's no longer here.
Mm-hmm.
How hard and long did you fret about what she might make of this portrayal?
You know, my mom was always very intuitive, I think, about her understanding of my direction in life.
Mm.
Like, I remember we were at a Blockbuster, and I don't know how this came up, but I remember us being in a Blockbuster when I was in middle school.
Uh-huh.
And we were just talking at the counter, and she said something. So, like, when you're doing debate in high school, da-da-da-da, and she just went on. And I was like, how do you, how do you know I'm going to do debate? And she just looked at me like, of course you're going to do debate. You know, and it was true. It wasn't like she wasn't imposing. I was just like, have you been eavesdropping on my brain? Like, what just happened? You know, my mom was always like that. Yeah. And when it came to things that I think she realized I was passionate about. So, you know, she knew. I remember being in graduate school and she called me one day and was like, yeah, I told your grandmother that you're planning on writing a memoir one day. And I was like, oh, how did that go? I was like, what did she say? And she was like, she just said, uh-oh. Which, you know, one, obviously what happens in the book, that's pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it just, I think I was in graduate school at that point. So, you know, I think there was just like an ongoing conversation. So I say all that to say, I wasn't anxious about writing about my mom. You know, she is clearly a vital part of the story of my life. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, well, you know, it would be like me, like, am I going to feel anxious about writing about being gay? Well, no, I can't tell my story without
telling that
weirdness in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's how I feel about her. I tried to be as thoughtful as possible in positioning how I explained the book. I remember when I sold the book and, you know, meeting with publishers, and the publishing industry is, I don't know, I think statistically it's something like 90% white or something.
Wow.
And I remember that I had this this awareness whenever I would say I grew up in Texas and my mom was a single parent, I was really aware of how I felt the other person was perceiving me. In that
really?
Moment,
what do you mean?
You know? Well, because I feel like there were so many ready-made stereotypes for Black single mothers, you know, or for my grandmother. You know, when I would say my grandmother is a very conservative, you know, Christian Black woman who's lived in Memphis her whole life. Like, and I would, like, look for the thought bubble. Like, what are you, you know? Yeah. And so it was really important for me to give them nuance. Mm. I need that nuance because I don't think it makes me a hero to make other people villains. And it also goes against the intention of the book, which is to examine how we are all fighting for our lives concurrently. Sometimes, unfortunately, when we are destructive, our fight, you know, comes at a cost for other people, but we're all trying to figure this out. And that's why I love opening the book with the poem.
Yeah.
To make it clear that, like, my mom is a human being. She is a person.
Yes.
Her name was Carol Sweet Jones. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Her existence is valid whether or not it's related to me. And obviously she was my mom, and that's our relationship, but I just wanted it to be very clear to readers that she had a life of her own, that my grandmother has a life of her own, and that they're not tools, they're not literary devices, they are people. And I wanted to convey that respect to readers.
We'll be right back. After the break, Saeed talks about coming to grips with his sexuality and coming out and how it all went with his family. Heads up, listeners, this next section contains frank discussions of sex. BRB.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the acclaimed true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
NPR's Code Switch is a podcast about race in America that's about all of us. Our histories, how we're represented, the ways we've worked together and worked against each other. You'll learn, you might get mad, you'll definitely laugh, but don't take my word for it. Just listen to NPR's Code Switch.
One of the big topics of the book is you figuring out your sexuality and then having to grapple with it. It was a journey for you. It's an ongoing process. Everything about a homosexual sexual awakening is different and harder than a heterosexual sexual awakening. Mm-hmm. For instance, you write about the first vivid sex dream you have as a boy, about mm-hmm. some other boy that you desire. But in this dream in which you desire this boy, he calls you faggot in the sex dream. Mm-hmm. And in the dream, mm-hmm. you like it? Or is that mm-hmm. even the right way to say it? But it was one of those things where it was like shame and desire were like mixing together, even in your subconscious, mm-hmm. even in your dreams.
Right.
Describe that dream for us if you can.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, my early kind of sex dreams, it was based on a boy, Cody, who appears in the book that I had such a crush on. And he was like mean as
he was. Oh, I don't like, I did not like Cody. So okay, mean. Can I just say, Cody was a trash man.
Cody is trash, the original trash bag.
Literally.
So terrible.
Yes.
But I had such a crush on him. Yeah. I just,
that's it, how it goes.
Stress me out.
That's how
yeah,
it goes.
I mean, and I described this in the book at one point, that one day when we were talking in our, you know, the parking lot of our apartment complex, I remember him standing close to me and saying something and being distracted because I was worried I was going to kiss him on accident. And I remember that it feels like, if you know people who are like afraid of bridges, mm-hmm. where it's just like, what, you think I'm going to jump off the bridge on accident? Like, what's going, but when you feel something so intensely, you kind of like don't even trust yourself.
Exactly.
And that was, you know, he was, and sadly I've felt this way many times about many trash men since. But he was, that was my first experience of that. Like, and it was just so overwhelming. And as you say, you know, of course, everyone has to come to terms with desire, right?
Yeah.
But queer people often, I hope this is becoming less and less true, but queer people often have to come to terms with desire in secret,
yes.
in private,
yes.
without information. You know, it's not like I'm like, oh, I could go pick up my sex ed manual that they read us in school and turn to the section on what does it mean to have feelings for boys? Like, no, we don't, we don't have that kind of public discourse for young people generally. So you're going through all of these feelings that are overwhelming for anyone, but especially if you're queer, you know? And yeah, so in my dreams, it was like I knew the desire, but I didn't, it was hard for me to even visualize. So often in my early teens, when I would dream about a crush or a boy, I would dream that I was a girl because I literally couldn't even form it. Like when people talk about representation and stuff, I'm like, well, this is a perfect example. I was like, I couldn't even imagine what it would look like for two men to kiss.
Yeah.
You know, like I couldn't even construct that, you know, and I should say, you know, this happens to be around the time when Queer as Folk is about to premiere on Showtime and other, you know, Will and Grace, you know, premieres not too long after.
But those weren't black boys from Louisville.
Hello, they weren't, you know? And so, so it was really a journey into like, how do you see yourself? And I think, you know, because our culture is dominated by and obsessed with straight, rich, cisgender people, I think those people will never fully understand how much work literally everyone else does to imagine ourselves into existence.
Yeah.
You know, just the strain and the effort. And I've talked to so many people, women, you know, just immigrants all over, you know, who are just like, whew, man, it's exhausting.
Yeah. You know? So this would not be a coming of age story about a young gay boy if there weren't an epic Pray the Gay Away moment. And when I tell you, I have never heard a Pray the Gay Away story as rich as the one you lay out in this book. I don't want to give away too many spoilers for folks that haven't read it yet, but how much can we talk about you and your grandmother in that church house?
Oh man. What a moment.
Saeed, when I tell you, it lingered on my person. I carried that story in my bones for a few days.
Wow.
Can we tell?
I have to be honest. I'll tell you, you know, it's one of the sections of the book that when I'm rereading the book, I usually skip over.
Wow.
I don't.
Wow.
It's just like, well, I read it. I know. It's fine. And I'm just like, let's just keep it going. Like, I literally will read about anything else. There's so many parts of the book that are so incredibly vulnerable. But that part of the book, it's deeply painful because, you know, my grandmother loves me. I believe my grandmother is a loving woman.
Yeah.
And she's very devoutly Christian.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, You know, my mom practiced Nichiren Buddhism, and that was a huge source of conflict in the book.
I can only imagine.
And in my family, yeah. It was like, I was like, I can't even go into that too much in the book, because that's a whole other book.
But, yeah.
I mean, it caused a huge rift in our family. And so by the time I was a preteen, you know, it was clear that the more conservative religious members of my family felt that the battle had moved to a new front. That, you know, it was like, we can't keep arguing with Carol forever. She's made up her mind. It seems like she's really stuck to this. But now there's Saeed to think about. It's deeply painful to read about, because it's a painful act of love.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think my grandmother, who basically, you know, as you will see in the book, basically asks a pastor, a visiting pastor at her church, to pray over me. And he prays basically a curse on my mother, right? But he basically hopes that my mother gets sick and suffers.
He's not just praying for you to become whatever your grandmother wants you to become. Mm-hmm. He's saying, in order to make sure that Saeed gets fixed, I pray a curse on his mother until that happens.
Right.
Because she's Buddhist.
Yeah. What a piece of work.
It was.
I swear. Man. Like, what, you know? Yeah, because there's totally a scenario in which this man's just like, oh, Jesus, let Saeed see the light. Let him, you know, believe all the good, wonderful. Yeah. Like, no, this curse of damnation and suffering is the only way you can see someone coming to appreciate what you, you know, claim to be this divine love. It's a mess.
I want to read the line that he says, because it just, they say, fight back, God, make her suffer, put every ailment, every disease on her until she breaks under the weight of the Holy Spirit. Show her your plagues and save this child. Amen. Mm. Whew.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing about writing a memoir is dialogue comes up. Inevitably, people need to talk.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, obviously, I can't remember what my mom and I said to each other on the phone at different moments. But that scene, I remember every single word.
Really?
I will be dead and gone and still remember every single word that man said. Because it, you know, I remember, like, you know, that feeling, particularly when you're a teenager, you can always tell when people are looking at you.
Oh, yeah, especially at an altar call. Right? Everyone's looking at you.
Exactly. I remember, like, walking across the high school cafeteria and walking to the front of the church always being huge sources of anxiety for me.
Yeah.
And so I remember what it felt like being dragged to the front of the church. I remember feeling everyone looking at me and, like any, you know, teenager, kind of being distracted by that. Like, you're embarrassing me. Like, let me go shrink back to the shadows.
Yeah. You
know, that's really what I was thinking about.
Yeah.
Until he said the word her. For some reason, that pronoun is what got my attention again. You know, because I was like, you know, I'm at this point, I'm like, Christians are crazy. Like, this has all been a pretty dramatic summer.
Yeah.
The bar is pretty low for my expectations for adults to not act crazy.
Yeah.
So I was already like, whatever's about to happen, I know it's going to be bad.
Yeah.
But when I heard him say the word her, like, as you've noted, that was such an unexpected.
Oh, my goodness.
And cruel.
Yeah.
And awful. I just couldn't, you know, it was one thing, I think, for my grandmother to take me to the front of the church and in front of 200 or 300 strangers, be like, his mother is Buddhist, help save him from damnation. Like, that was one thing. But the cruelty to say, well, our solution is, like, to wish suffering on another person, that shocked me.
Yeah.
You know? And so when I say the chapter is painful, because there are different painful moments in the book, it's painful because I feel so sad for my grandmother. That this was how she was expressing her love for me.
Have you forgiven your grandmother?
I have. I have.
How long did it take?
Oh, it took a long time. It did. Mm. And because we couldn't talk about it, because it wasn't something that, like, we could have a knockdown, drag-out argument about, it became a silence. And you see this, the silence is, to me personally, one of the more significant themes throughout the book. You see kind of what happens when people stop talking about that obviously important thing. But what happens over time with these silences is at some point you begin to actually forget what you're angry about.
So it got to the point
where I just, like, I just had this cold, toxic relationship with my grandmother, and I couldn't even remember why most times. I just knew that I didn't like her very much, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I remember in the years before she died, my mom was going back to Memphis a lot to take care of my grandmother. She was thinking about actually moving from Atlanta, where she lived, back to Memphis. And I'd be like, are you crazy? But I wouldn't say why. I was just like, you crazy, you know? And she'd be like, oh, Saeed, stop it. You know, but I remember noticing I was like, huh? Because she had had her own. Some of my earliest memories are my mother and my grandmother arguing, you know, like she'd been through her own crucible with them over religion, you know, and yet towards the end of her life, like most of my memories of my mom are her loving her family, taking care of them.
Oh yeah.
So I remember, you know, just before she passed away, kind of being like, I think I need to move on and I don't know how, but I need to move on. And I'm not going to say I'm grateful for this experience, but my mom passing away pushed me to put my sword down because it just felt bigger than all of us.
It is the beauty of the book because, like, in many ways, the story you tell is uniquely your own. But in so many ways, the story you tell is one that all of us are going to have to deal with. You know, a parent dying, a sick family member, going away to college, et cetera, et cetera. In writing the book, how much time did you spend thinking about the interplay between the specific and the universal?
I don't think I thought about it very much. Mm. You know, it's interesting, you know, when I was selling the book, and I point to it because it's such a bizarre experience when the book you're selling is a memoir, because you find yourself in the position of sitting in conference rooms in Midtown New York, talking to usually rooms of white people, explaining, like, and people say, like, who's the audience for this book? Which in my mind, I'd be like, so who do you think would care about your life? Why, what kind of reader would care about your mother? You know, it's just a weird thing where you're trying to, get someone to understand, you know, I'm like, you should just care because you should care.
But yeah, because I'm a good writer. Read this book.
Exactly. Yeah. So I remember that, having that dynamic and being like, well, everybody has a mom, as far as I know, you know, you know, everyone, you know, and as I went into the book, my kind of organizing logic was that, like, listen, the work of fighting for our lives, of developing our understanding of power and gender is intense work, and it could be dangerous. And so I was like, here's the thing, here's my pitch. Like, if a man has not figured out his gender politics, and most men have not, let's be honest, he is like a Ford F-150 speeding down the highway, you know, swerving, you know, which is to say, he is not just dangerous to himself, he's dangerous to every other person on the road. You know, so my memoir, like, it is my coming of age story. It is about me and the factual events that defined the, you know, first early years of my life. But also it's a project that helps us understand, we have to understand what's going on. Because when we don't, we are a danger to ourselves and everyone else.
One more break. When we come back, Saeed tells me about a time that he actually fought for his life during a violent sexual encounter. As a reminder, this next part contains more discussion of sex and violence as well. Okay, BRB.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Hero Bread. Burger buns, tortillas, and fluffy breads, and oh, so many carbs. Hero Bread makes healthier versions of these carb favorites. Fewer calories, 0 to 2 grams net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, great taste. With more of the dietary fiber and protein you want with no compromise. Don't skip out on your favorites. Just use Hero Bread. Get 10% off your order at hero.co with code HEROPOD at checkout. That's HEROPOD at HERO.CO.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, one of the hosts of On Point, the NPR show that takes you behind the headlines. We've done a deep dive series on education, and all episodes are available to binge now. Listen to On Point now on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Flash forward to college, you end up at Bowling Green, and you are you are getting to have as much sex as you want, but you
so much sex. Oh my god!
But you end up having a lot of sex with a lot of men who are either downright mean to you or are trying to hurt you. Mm-hmm. There was the one guy who's into some weird race play who has, like, literally a jungle set up in his bedroom. Mm-hmm. And then there's the guy who kind of comes on to you, but after y'all are hooking up, he tries to beat you up.
Yeah.
How long did it take you and your therapist to unpack what you were doing there?
He is in the acknowledgments for this book.
Good.
How long did it take me to unpack? You know, I mean, I think... I mean, it's ongoing.
Okay.
You know, I think,
stop
you
letting
know,
them hit you, Saeed, if it's ongoing.
Girl, well, you know, now I hit back. It's, this is terrible. This is so dark. This is so dark. I mean, you know, I think for me, my major life questions, I just have to write about. And I don't mean that in, like, writing is, like, some kind of emotionally cathartic. And once I was able to write about Cody or the botanist or whatever, you know, like, the clouds cleared. It's just, like, I need to be able to look at dynamics with a sense of distance.
Yeah.
And I am such a cold, distant writer. I am wow. just like in a lab coat
wow.
writing. And so that allows me, I think, to really think through. Because it's like, well, if I have to think about Saeed as a character and go, well, why would Saeed do that? How would Saeed respond to that? What would the, you know, yeah. that allows me to begin to go, oh, okay, I'm seeing something here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so it took a very long time. Shout out to therapy.
Shout out. Yes.
Shout out to shout out to feminism.
Yeah.
Shout out to what I do think is, it's still burgeoning, but a better cultural conversation about race and sex. I mean, the fact that you and I can be having this conversation, you know,
yeah,
it is a step forward.
It is.
I'm not going to pretend like everything's great, but like this is helpful.
Yes.
You know, and certainly if I think about a younger version of myself being able to listen to the two of us talk right now, like that's beautiful and really powerful. My theory is that for better or worse, many of our early relationships are kind of like science experiments, right? We're using another person to learn something about ourselves. And that's not like great, but like, I don't know, how else are you going to do it?
That's true. Right?
Like the first time, you know, like it's just, it is what it is. You can't do like a virtual reality model, you know? So you know, you go out and you have these firsts. And yeah, I mean, what you see in the book is me literally using these experiences to try to understand myself.
Yeah.
I think I was trying to see myself. And the problem with that, of course, is the vision was distorted. You know,
the vision was based in shame.
It was based in shame. It was warped by shame and insecurity and racism and homophobia. And, you know.
And so you were drawing men that would fulfill that vision for you, I guess, in some ways.
Hello, because isn't that what everything was going on? You know, my junior year of college was the year that there was the Supreme Court decision on Lawrence v. Texas, which was the end of anti-sodomy. So until I was a junior in high school, technically, in the state of Texas, gay men could have still been arrested for having sex.
Wow.
If that is the cultural context in which people are growing up,
yeah,
is it that surprising that, you know, this is what manifests in people's lives?
Exactly.
No, that shame is just there.
Yeah, yeah. There's this moment after the jock who starts sucker punching you mid-fellatio. You diffuse the situation, but before you know it, you're writing about how you're working through in your own way forgiving him. That really surprised me. Did your ability to show empathy and forgiveness towards him so quickly, did it surprise you as well?
I've never thought about that. That's such a really, what a wonderful question. I just want to sit here and marvel at the question for a moment instead of answering it. No, I don't think I thought about it. The thing about people being deeply cruel and terrible is that they're also being very true, right? Like the moment when someone screams a slur or commits a terrible act of violence, like that's all awful, but also it's the most purest form of expression. And so you're seeing something, you know, in that moment, even if unfortunately you're the person on the other side of that violence, like, you know, and I just feel like I've had these moments when I've seen, you know, violence. And in that moment, I just feel like, oh my God, you know, like you're trying to express yourself. Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, I'm so sorry that you feel this is necessary. Daniel, I swear if you could have been in the room when Daniel and I are wrestling on that floor, if you had been in my head, you would have thought I was beating him up.
Wow.
He was terrified. Wow. He was so, so scared.
Scared of his own desire.
And
scared for
of his own desire.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just remember, you know, and I remember how absurd and silly that this tall, huge kind of football player build dude would be afraid of me. I'm like, I just want to have sex with you, sir. So I'm definitely not trying to hurt you. But also, it's so deeply funny to me that you would ever think I would want to hurt you. Mm. And he kept saying, I'm so evil, I'm so evil, I'm so evil, and you're already dead. And I'd be like, I'm not dead, and you're not evil. You need to stop before you do something. You know, like, yeah. I just felt deep compassion for him. And, you know, we have to understand what's going on. We have to figure out how to connect and communicate with these people, because all of our lives are on the line.
Yes.
Right? And I've been on a journey.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of time to think about this. Obviously, I'm not going to pretend that in the moment, you know, I had such high-minded, elevated thoughts. Though I do remember thinking about, like, bell hooks and Audre Lorde essays at one point. I was in women's studies. I was really in it.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I do know that my desire to express compassion for him felt like such an essential part of what was happening.
Yes.
And I remember being so, literally as we were still fighting each other, I remember being heartbroken that he couldn't seem to understand that I only wished him well, you know? Mm. And it's just like when you see, it's kind of like if you're around someone and they're blackout drunk and they don't know it.
Oh, yeah.
And what it means to see someone so out of their element, and you're just like, oh my God.
Feel bad for
you know?
Him.
That's what it felt like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Hearing you talk about the way you treated him and the compassion you showed him, it is entirely not in line with this current moment of cancel culture. But I think that's good because, like,
interesting.
If we cancel all the Daniels, they don't just stop hurting people. They just keep hurting people. And the only way to, I mean, it's the work shouldn't have to fall on the oppressed or the victims of that hurt. But, like, if we don't find some ways to help the Daniels, if we just say you're canceled, go away, it doesn't make them less violent. It doesn't make them less reactionary. It doesn't mean that they don't go off and hurt other people. Do you think that the story of empathy and compassion that you had in that moment is a culture in that place writ large right now? It feels like we're not.
I never had thought about the relationship between, you know, the kind of cancel conversation and the book. So, wow. Oh my gosh. It is one of the joys of writing a book is getting to talk with readers.
Oh, yeah.
And I think readers are in some ways so much more intelligent than writers. And so it's just like such an honor to be like, oh, wow. Okay. Oh, cool. You know, thank you. I will say, I think what often drives the conversation is this dynamic where, how do I explain it? I guess it's a kind of projection. Like, I find that, like, powerful people and people who have a lot to lose talk about cancel culture a lot more than the ones of us who are actually out here losing.
You know,
it's this kind of, you know, I don't know. I just remember in college, like, noticing that, you know, if you knew a couple and the guy was cheating on his girlfriend, he would start constantly accusing his girlfriend of cheating on him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this weird projection. And so I feel like that's kind of what I see happening with cancel culture. Like, cancel is out again. And I'm like, no, you're just worried that whatever shady dealings you are doing.
To come to light
are eventually going to come to light and you will be held to account.
Yeah.
So that's what it is. But that being said, I just don't think I'm above it. You know, like, I'm not above men like Daniel and Cody. Yes, they are trash, but I guess I'm trash too. We just gonna be in the dumpster together. And it just doesn't seem logical for me to imagine a realistic scenario where I just pretend like these people don't exist anymore just because I don't like it's just not possible.
Yeah.
Because as you see in the book, the only thing worse than being in the fight is pretending that you're not.
Wow.
You know? And I think to be like, cancel, you don't exist, you're out of here. You know, da, da, da. It, like you said, that violence, that danger, self-destructive and outwardly destructive, is not going to end in that moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the most dangerous thing I could have done after having that experience with Daniel is not write about it. You know, is pretend that it didn't happen.
Yeah.
As we see, these men are our brothers. They are our presidents. They are our bosses. They are our lovers. They are our children. Yeah. Like, we have to figure out how to communicate and get them to listen. I'm not going to act like people aren't here out here doing the work, yeah. You know. But this is a vital conversation because our lives are on the line.
Last question for you. Mm-hmm. I have thought long and hard about the title of this book, How We Fight for Our Lives. And I like it because it's a phrase that becomes what you need in the moment. And there were some days I was reading the book where that title meant one thing to me and other days where it meant something else. Mm. I wonder, how does that change for you, this phrase, how we fight for our lives? And how are you fighting for your life today?
Wow. You know, I love that you said, like, you know, the title seems to change in meaning as you go. As you're reading the book. Yeah. That was absolutely part of the intention. Mm. You know, I knew when I sold the book, and I think this is actually like a beautiful part of the writing process and what can develop. When I sold the book, it was based on an essay that I wrote about Daniel and the incident in Phoenix. So the title was How Men Fight for Their Lives. Uh-huh. And that title was based on the moment when I'm wrestling with him and I look at him and I realize, I say, like, he was a man who believed he was fighting for his life. You know, so it's already got this kind of like dialectic that's very complicated.
Yeah.
But I sold the book, How Men Fight for Our Lives. That was going to, that, you know, the gender masculinity aspect of the book was really going to be the focus. But as we expand, and I remember feeling uncomfortable because I just never in my life want to write a book with the word man on the cover. But I remember being like, oh, I don't know. Because even earlier on, I was like, well, but my mom was fighting for her. Like, I knew that. I was just like, oh, I don't know, you know. But we, when we expanded the book, it felt like a gesture towards opening up the idea that, this, you know, I don't want people to read my memoir or any of my writing, really, and think of it as a vacation from the reality of their own lives. I hope everything I write, when you experience it as a reader, it feels like it's in dialogue with your life, you know? So, yeah, I think, how am I fighting for my life now? I think it is what the book is. I had this experience. I've now been able to crystallize it literally into an object that I can put in other people's hands and now use it as the beginning of a conversation.
Yeah.
The book is the beginning of a conversation that I want us all to have.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm really grateful to be able to do so.
I'm grateful for it, too. Saeed Jones, thank you for the fight.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again to author Saeed Jones. His new memoir, How We Fight for Our Lives, it's out now. Listeners, as always, we want to hear from you on this show as well. Usually on this show, we ask y'all to share with us every week the best things that have happened to you all week. We want to hear that. Keep those best things coming. But this week, we also want you to share with us the wackiest parts of your week. The strange thing, the funny thing, the surprising thing. The video you'd send in to America's Funniest Home Videos. Share those stories with us, too, and we might reach out to you for a little interview. As always, just record yourself and email those files, those stories, those fun moments, to samsanders@npr.org, samsanders@npr.org. All right, that's a wrap. We are back in your feeds Friday. Till then, keep fighting for your lives. I'm Sam Sanders. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing. Visit your local REI Co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways to opt outside.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.